But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire. But don't play with me, 'cause you're playing with fire.
Good morning, welcome to Playing with Fire, Long Island's only food, wine, and lifestyle show. I'm your host, Tom Shortell, and I'm here, as usual, with co-host and producer Stu Schrager. Good morning, Stu.
Good morning, Tom. The temperatures these in the 70s and 80s, it's incredible.
Yeah, it's climate change, Stu. It's climate change. I have, it's funny you talk about climate change since SUVs come out, and, you know, it's always the human's fault and this, that, and the other thing. But I remember about 40 years ago playing golf on a day in January where it was 60, so it's always been a little... You know, you always have those freak days.
Yeah, no, I remember way back when, had to be in the early 80s, pouring the floor in my house that was under construction. And the concrete, it was New Year's Eve, and the concrete workers were in short sleeves.
Yeah. Well, Ken, climate does change. It does, especially if you live in the Northeast, like four times a year generally. But, yeah, whatever. So I did a book signing this past week at an interesting place in Oyster Bay called the Wine Line, and it's a little wine bar that opened up, I guess, about maybe 3-4 months ago, and it was fun. We had a bunch of people come down. Our friend Bill O'Leary was there. Brought his brother down. His brother from California.
Really?
Yeah. So he was there. An old friend, Jim Molitor, came down. I had some friends. My friends Billy and Joanne showed up, and we had a real good time. It was a lot of fun.
Now, how did you get connected to that destination?
Through Steve Israel,
the congressman. That's right.
Yeah, he's got the bookstore across the street, and it's not big enough to do what we did. So I guess he knows them across the street. You know, Oyster Bay is becoming quite the little food hamlet. They have, they opened up Stellina in Oyster Bay. I don't know if you've ever been there, but it's a little Italian restaurant. No. It's an odd location. It's behind the building that abuts the parking lot for a municipal parking lot behind Audrey Avenue, where the town offices are, mm-hmm. So they opened up Stellina it used to be Osteria Liana, and Peter Vander something, I can't remember if it's R-I-I-S or something, Vanderis. Anyway, he was the chef there, had a place called Osteria Liana. He's over at, I think it's called 225 now in Locust Valley. But anyway, cute little place, and they opened up Stellina, and now they've opened up the Wine Line, which is this wine bar. And next door they have Stellina Bakery. And then you have another group, Chef Jesse Schenker, or Schenkner. He opened up 2 Spring Street there, and he's got 2 Spring, and then he's got Smash Burger, which is another little place. And he opened up a place next to 2 Spring called 4 Spring, which is this tasting menu kind of operation. And now he's just opened up a little Italian restaurant called Gioia, right on, I guess it's Main Street there. So it's kind of Oyster Bay's kind of blossomed into this, almost like a foodie town, almost like, Farmingdale did.
Mm-hmm.
Farmingdale, all of a sudden, all of these restaurants were opening up. It's great. And so for me, it's, because I spend some time in Oyster Bay, I'm up there frequently. And it's nice to see that thing happening, the town alive and thriving. Especially towns that are off the beaten path, because you have to be, it's Oyster Bay is a destination. You're not just going to blow through it. It's up north. It's like Bayville. You have to be.
And Babylon's similar to that. There's a pretty nice dining scene.
Patchogue, too. Patchogue has exploded, It's nice to see. It's nice to see these towns that were a little bit run down, all of a sudden, boom, there's interest in living there. There's interest in being there. And, one thing begets the other. That's what people don't understand. You start, when you promote business instead of punishing businesses, like some government officials want to do, when you promote them, it drags everybody there, Patchogue now has all these great apartment buildings that are going up, and people want to live there because there's things to do. And, you can walk around town. You don't have to drive if you want to. It's almost like a little city, like Huntington is,
Yeah.
If you live in Huntington, you don't really need a car, and, eliminates the driving while drinking thing, and you can go out and have some fun and, walk home. It's great.
So It was a book signing. Did you have a discussion? Was there a food sampling?
Yeah, it was all of the above. We did a book signing, and then I did my usual dog and pony show, you know, the stand-up crazy customer thing. We did a question-and-answer session, and people are always interested in restaurants and how they run and why they run and what they run. So, we did that. We did a question-and-answer session, and we did a little humor thing, and it was fun. People were really engaged, and, you know, they were asking a bunch of questions, and when you bought your ticket, it came with a book, I think, one drink, and a little charcuterie platter. I figured I'd say that for you.
Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. But I also brought some pass around hors d'oeuvres. I brought lamb meatballs with a cumin yogurt dip, and I also brought arugula. But I brought a savory arugula. I made arugula with onion jam and goat cheese, which was kind of fun. Usually, when you think of arugula, you're thinking of raspberry jam or blueberry jam or something like that. You know, apricot jam. But you can make savory arugula with, you know, whatever savory cheeses or whatever you want to do in there. So that's what we did. It was a lot of fun. I guess I started at about 7. I guess we ended at around 9:15, something like that. I had a glass of wine. And, you know, I've been eating there once in a while. I had, I should say I've been eating there. I've eaten there twice now. And both times I had flatbreads, which are really good. It may be the best pizza in Oyster Bay at this point. I'm sure I'm going to piss somebody off if I say that, but it's really good. He makes his pinza, though, which is kind of it's a Roman thing, you know, and they're rectangular. They're really good. I mean, the dough is really good. He does a good job with that. I had the meatballs; they were good, you know. The wine list is fun. I personally would, you know, expand it a little. I don't want to criticize anybody, but for me, it's a little bit short. But, you know, you can certainly find things to drink there. I mean, I've found, you know, things that I thought that were really good that I hadn't had before. So, go there. I mean, it's on Audrey Avenue in Oyster Bay, and a great little place, great little place. Ask for Faith. She's a great bartender. She used to work at the inn at the Syosset there, the in-between. And she's over there now, and she's a very nice woman, and knows her wines, and I think you'll have a good time. It's a great
spot. Certainly sounds interesting.
Yeah, it's a great spot, you know. I mean, wine bars appeal to me personally because I'm such a wine head, but you very rarely get great ones. I think the biggest problem I've seen with the wine bars is that a lot of times the people that open them don't really know a lot about wine. They know that they like it, and they know a little bit about it, and they rely on the salespeople. And the result is you become a dumping ground for the salesperson. You know, he's got to get rid of this. There's a special on that. You know, if I sell 3 cases of this, I get a trip to California. You know, there's all kinds of shenanigans that go on in that business if you don't know it. And I think that I've seen wine bars. I'm not going to name them, but I've seen wine bars that fall victim to that. And, you know, it is what it is. I tell you, the people who do a good job with that, who, what's the place in Babylon? Barik. They have figured it out. You know, they have really nice wines by the glass. There's somebody there that knows what's going on and knows the business, and they do a good job. If you're ever in Babylon and you want a nice little wine by the glass experience, Barik is as good as it gets.
And have you dined there or just sat at the bar?
Good. Yeah, food's good. You know, they do a lot of small plate stuff and things like that. I think it's the same group that owns the place across the street, Argyle.
Oh, really?
And I guess they own Hemingway's, too, and Wantagh. I don't know if they still do. I forget the principal's names now. I've met them. They're nice guys, and they do a good job. They do, you know, they're committed guys and, you know, good restaurant worker guys, and, you know, they know the business, and I think they do a fine job. You know, it's hard. I mean, people don't realize how hard this business is. And when you get people who are doing multiple things, it gets even harder because, you know, most of the talent in one, if you have one place, all the talent's obviously concentrated there. Once you start splitting it up, it just changes everything. And, you know, me included, you know, I've fallen victim to that too, you know, where, you know, something suffers if you're not there. So, you know, but one of the guys asked me a very interesting question, and he was trying to do it without making me feel bad or whatever. I caught the tone in his voice. It was almost apologetic. But he says, can I ask you a question? He says, you know, we've been to all your restaurants and you've been here and there and this, that, and the other thing. How come you never had that one iconic restaurant that lasted 30 years, you know? I was like, well, here's the deal. I knew Charlie Trotter, who had this restaurant, famous restaurant in Chicago. He's a chef and talented guy. Sadly passed away too early from an aneurysm, of all things. And anyway, he said one time when I was talking to him, I said, you know, you got all this press, you know, you're a national figure. You know, have you thought about Vegas or something else? He goes, I will not spend one day off the line in my restaurant. And I'm like, wow, that is commitment, you know. And so I told this gentleman who was asking me the question, I said, you know, I'm not that guy. I mean, you have builders and you have maintainers. I mean, some people will stay there forever and do that one restaurant and make sure it's as good as it can possibly be, and they're committed to that one location. I have the attention span of a two-year-old, so I needed to do other things. And I didn't really open restaurants because I thought I'd make more money. Because if you've had one, you realize how delusional that'll be. But I also had very talented people that I was going to lose if I didn't give them something to do. You know, so, I mean, with me being the chef, there's a glass ceiling in my restaurant. The sous chef is never going to be the chef because I'm the guy, right? But if I open up a second one, I can promote the sous chef to the chef, get another guy, promote him to sous chef. And so that's what happened, and that's how it started. It started by me trying to keep talented people around, not trying to, you know, make a lot of money or whatever. Because I'm bad at business. I think I'm pretty good at restaurants. I just don't have the gene or the whatever it is. I don't care all that much. I mean, I care, you know. But there's guys that care a lot more than I do and are a lot better at it. So, but that was the reason. And you know, again, people don't understand how difficult this business is. And we also got into a discussion about these websites like Tri-State Restaurant Group and Yelp and all this other stuff.
Favorite subject of yours.
Yeah, well, yeah, you know, I can go on for two shows about that. But, you know, the thing is, it's easy to sit back and bitch and moan about, you know, things that happen. My problem with like a site like Tri-State Restaurant Group is that it's always an after the fact thing. You know, why don't you let management know at the time that there's a problem, and this at least give them a chance to fix it. You know, most places will just fix it. And I find that there's a lot of fiction in these things because I've been on the business end of some of these reviews. And there's a couple I can tell you that bore absolutely no resemblance to what really happened. So, you know, people go home and, you know, they start spinning fiction at 3 a.m. in their underwear with a martini in them. And, you know, all of a sudden it turns into the hostess was rude, the telephone was broken, the bathroom was terrible, it was dirt on the floor, the oysters were some, my wife had diarrhea. It turns into this whole mishmash of, you know, stuff. And I always tell a story about, you know, when I opened Kingfish, I got that scathing review. And the review came out 8 days before I was even open. So that was on Yelp. And then 2 days later, I called Yelp and I'm like, I have this terrible review here. He says, well, we can't do anything about that. It's somebody's opinion. I said, well, it's not somebody's opinion because I'm not open yet. We haven't had any public dining here, you know. So I need you to take that down. He says, well, I can't take it down for 5 business days. So that review was up there for 5 business days. A review that never happened, and I believe it's a bot or somebody working for Yelp, because 2 days later I get this call from Yelp. Hey, Tom, your restaurants generate a lot of traffic, man. You know, we can help you out. $200 a month, we can manage the bad reviews, keep the good ones there, this, that, and the other thing. So I'm like, really, what a coincidence you would call today, you know, 5 days after, you know, a review that never happened. So, you know, when you read these things, when, you know, if you're using Yelp as a guide to go to restaurants in maybe a town you don't know, bring a pound of salt with you because you need a grain or two to get through these things. And again, you know, even Tri-State, you know, most of this stuff is the opinions of people who need to be heard or who want to be involved, who want to matter, you know. And okay, fine, have your opinions, but for God's sake, I mean, don't base your decisions on this stuff. I mean, I've heard people, you know, I've read things where people had a bad experience at a restaurant and 9 people go, well, I'll never go there. You know, well, you're basing it on her or him. I mean, I don't get it, you know. Just go try it. Maybe it may not be the you know, not every restaurant's for everybody, you know. I've certainly experienced that, you know, if nothing else. So I think those sites are a strange phenomenon that happened in the restaurant business. You know, we used to have critics, professional critics, who were at least trained in writing and, you know, have some experience eating out and know when to pull back and when to, you know, throw an accolade. And, you know, that's not the case anymore. Now it's just free-for-all. And I don't know if that's so good for the restaurant business. I mean, it's hard enough without, you know, people bashing you. And again, you know, with the anonymity, you don't know who it is. I mean, a great review could be my mother. You know, a terrible review could be somebody I fired, or it could be somebody, a competitor or whatever. You know,
well,
you
that's
know.
Always the fear.
Yeah.
I mean, how many restaurants or businesses reach out to all their friends to do a review?
Of course. Of course, the whole thing's so silly, you know. At least with a, you know, with a professional. I mean, I was on the other end of Peter Giannotti and Joanne Starkey and Barbara Rader, going back all the way to Barbara Rader, Mike McGrady, all these guys for years and years and years, you know. And I always respected those people. I could get annoyed at them or something for a comment, but, you know, and they probably reviewed 25 of my restaurants over the years, you know. And I remember we got a bad review when I was in East Hampton. And the problem was we weren't ready to open. There was panic because the season was starting, and it was just a mishmash of stuff that was going on. And I opened, and it wasn't good. Admittedly, it wasn't good. So we got a one-star review. It was the only time it ever happened to me, right? So all of my entire staff, the employees, they were all PO'd, you know, all mad. You know, oh, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about, this, that, and the other thing. So anyway, I went down to the hardware store, and I got a frame. And I framed the review, and I hung it in the kitchen. And my employee said, why would you do something like that? He doesn't know what he's talking about. This place is great, you know, the whole thing. I said, listen, he doesn't have anything against me or you or any of us. He saw what he saw. He felt what he felt. He ate what he ate. He wrote what he wrote, all right? I want you to look at this review every day that you come in here, and I want you to read it, and I want you to never let this happen again. And that's what happened. It never did happen again, you know.
That's pretty cool.
Well, I think that, you know, look, the bottom line is these people eat out all the time, right, and professional reviewers. And most of them are measured in their comments. Not all of them. Most of them are measured in their comments. And the bottom line is it is what it is. If you get a 3-star review, good for you. If you get a 4-star, great. If you get a 2-star, well, you may be disappointed. 1-star, you may be mad. But the bottom line is, it's your fault. You know, these people don't have a personal vendetta against anybody, you know. They're just doing a job like the rest of us are. And I think that, you know, if you get a bad review, you got to learn from it. You got to just suck it up, be a man and learn from it. I was in a restaurant that I won't tell you who it was, and they had just gotten reviewed, a month or two before. And at the time, all of us always read everybody's reviews. You know, we always, it was the first thing I would do on Sunday was to read the review, the restaurant reviews, just because I'm interested, right? And I know that this guy got 2 stars, right? Which isn't a terrible review, but, you know, I'm sure they were hoping for 3 or whatever. Anyway, so I'm in his place about, I don't know, a month later, a month and a half later. And he's got a frame review on the wall, and I'm standing right next to it. And I look, and I see it's a 3-star review. But one of the stars is kind of positioned wrong. You know what I mean? It's like it was just a little low and a little close kind of thing. And I'm like, oh, no, man. Are you kidding? You can't do that, you know? I'm looking at this thing. So the chef came out, and, of course, I can't keep my mouth shut, you know? And I'm like, it's just so wrong, you know? And I looked at him, I said, hey, I didn't realize you got 3 stars. And all of a sudden, he's humming, humming, humming. He's doing a Jackie Gleason on me, you know? And I'm like, he says, well, you know, what really happened was we got 2, but my partner thought that Peter Giannotti had a cold that day and he couldn't really taste anything. I'm like, I'll call him John. I'm like, John, you can't do that, man. You're looking foolish. No, it's wrong. I mean, I don't care. You leave it up. It's your business. But I'm telling you, man. People are going to notice that and think you're an idiot, you know, and don't do it, you know. So I don't know if you took it down or not because I didn't go back, but you can't fake that stuff. It is what it is. If you get a review that you don't like, go learn. Listen, I've had my share of 3-star reviews. I've had 1 4-star review, and I've had a couple of 2-star reviews. And there were times where, you know, I thought maybe that 2-star review could have been a 3. There were also times where I thought that 3-star review could have been a 2, and I was kind of surprised because of what went on. So I think it all balances out at some point. And ultimately, now that's all gone. We used to live and die by the reviews. And, you know, in the restaurant business, you'd wait for a review to come out. And the rule of thumb was that if you got 4 stars, you were busy for 4 years, three years, two years, 1 year, you know. And I remember when I opened Beiju, we got 4 stars. We were the only Japanese restaurant or sushi place in the history of Long Island that ever got 4 stars. And I was busy for like an hour and a half, and then it's gone, you know. But now it's all social media, like you were saying before. We were talking about that. You know, it's TikTok, I guess they call it. I don't know any of this stuff. But, you know, all social media-driven business. Everybody's taking pictures of the food, you know. And they'll sit there and they'll act like Richard Avedon for 20 minutes, you know, taking pictures of the food and then send it back because it's cold. You know what I mean? It's like, well, if you would just eat instead of, you know, being a journalist, you'd be fine, you know.
No, that's very funny. There's so many people that... I used to make fun of my father because he would take pictures. Then we have to wait for him to develop the pictures. When we finally see him a year later. Yeah. Again, today everybody's taking pictures, posting them, whatever. So a quick update.
Yeah.
Hemingway's in Wantagh no longer is.
Oh, really?
It's become Craft Kitchen and Tap House.
Oh, okay.
Apparently, it's owned by Anthony, I don't know if you know these names, Garassi and Thomas McNicholas. Who also own Casey's in Rockville Center.
I don't know them, no.
And somehow they both have a little bit of ownership in Hanu Kitchen in Huntington.
Yeah, that's just that was just sold, Hanu Kitchen.
I thought a John Toomey restaurant.
It was, yeah. But they sold it, so I don't know who bought it now. I know that Lou from West End Cafe, I think, has a little bit of an interest in there. So
a couple of random things. I was looking through one of my foodie magazines, and I saw a recipe for turkey and butternut squash lasagna with crispy sage.
Yeah, sounds good to me. I would do that.
Okay. I was curious.
I used to make a butternut squash lasagna over in Jewel for vegetarians, you know. And it's kind of cool, you know. You know, butternut squash you got to be careful with because there's not a lot of flavor there. You got to kind of amp it up a little, you know. So we would do that with, you know, onions and celery and stuff like that. And then... You know, it's seasoned with a little brown sugar and cinnamon and all the spice and kind of, you get the fall flavor, nutmeg, you know, that kind of thing.
Well, it's funny. When you start talking about that, I was invited to a family gathering of Kerry's family for the holidays, all her siblings.
Uh-huh.
And she's got a large family. And her sister and brother-in-law prepared some ham and a lot of side dishes or whatever. And it was all really, really good. And Kerry goes, a lot of butter was used for this stuff.
Butter is fat is flavor. People don't get it, you know what I mean? That's why oils are used. That's why butter's used. That's why cheeses are used, you know. There's flavor in fat, you know. There's not a lot of flavor in lettuce, you know, kind of thing. So I think, you know, you got to make a decision. You're either going to eliminate all that stuff from your life and be miserable, or you'll die 2 years earlier and be happy. You know, I don't know.
It was delightful. They had an... You know, carrots, again, in a butter sauce. There was onions and cream. Creamed onion.
Yeah.
There was ham. They had glaze for the ham. They
Yikes.
Had different mustards.
Nice.
There was mashed potatoes. There was croissants or some sort of muffin.
Wow.
It was really, really nice.
Eat better than I do. It's hard to believe.
Now, talking about eating nice... it was very different. I was over at the mansion in Glen Cove and met your friend Rodrigo Bernal.
Rodrigo. I love Rodrigo. Good guy.
So, great guy. And I was a guest at a wild game dinner.
Oh, yeah?
So I was tasting because I couldn't really get into it. I got to admit, I was
really?
A little scared. But anything from
You're bear. You're such a wuss. What happened?
Bear sliders.
Yeah.
There was wild boar, kangaroo.
Uh-huh.
There was a couple of different sausages. There was gator.
Yeah.
Ostrich. And the ostrich came out looking like filet mignon.
Yeah,
dark. Rodrigo was saying that, you know, ostrich you got to cook very rare.
Otherwise. Oh, yeah. Otherwise, it tastes like liver. Yeah.
And then he was talking about how, I don't know what the right terminology would be, but a lot of those meats... He said had to be prepped so they didn't taste gamey and to get rid of all the the nasty stuff, as he put it.
Uh-huh.
But like the gator, he said he had to soak in a brine, and he cooked it with. I guess he brined it, and then he cooked it in with sausage and shrimp and a bunch of different things. But that was interesting. It tasted like chicken. It really did. A little salty.
Yeah, that's from the brine, probably.
But it was, incredibly interesting. Just a wild assortment.
How'd you get through the bear sliders, did you?
I was listening to what other people said. It's funny.
You didn't taste it?
I had it. But where you get really weird is that I guess there were condiments to you know, like for the sliders, they had cheese and onions and lettuce and everything.
Ketchup.
And ketchup. But, again, that sort of masks, I thought, what it was all about. I'm curious on your take. Or that's the means by which you get to where you go.
Well, I don't know. I think some meats, you know, require, you know, help, condiments. I mean, filet mignon needs a sauce because it's kind of dry. It's no fat, right? And, you know, they have steak sauce out there for all the steak people. I don't think there's anything wrong with it. It's like, I mean, when was the last time you ate a hamburger with nothing on it? You know, cheese or ketchup or whatever.
But going back to what you asked, it seemed less fatty than traditional beef.
Yeah.
And then, there were a whole bunch of different types.
It was ground? Like a hamburger?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yes.
Okay.
And then there was a whole bunch of different sausages. And then there was like a raspberry sauce. I forget if that was for the sausage or something, or the boar or something.
Yeah.
But it really was. And there was spaghetti and meatballs, but it was venison meatballs.
Okay.
And Rodrigo said that he didn't grind the meat; it had come that way.
Yeah, you can get that.
But he's an interesting individual. I guess there's some decent traffic in that venue. Because it's a hotel and catering hall, but he served the cannoli cake for dessert, which, you know, not going out to the bakery to get. He prepared it.
Yeah.
So it was, and he was so proud of everything. Again, he was the means by which everything got cooked.
Uh-huh.
The host had procured all the different meats or whatever, but it was it definitely was interesting to be able to say. You know, I ate kangaroo. I ate this. I ate that.
Well, he's a good guy. He was at Eisenhower Park forever. You know, that place. That's where I know him from. Actually, so I did a lot of charity events over there. And a good cook, good guy. You know, I guess that ultimately he had to leave there because I guess they were closing and changing the venue, whatever. But he's been at that mansion in Glen Cove for a couple of years now.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was called to that place through a friend of mine when the owner first bought it to maybe consult or tell him what to do. And I don't know. The thing was, it's a difficult venue where the kitchen is and the size of it and all of that. So I really wasn't interested. And I don't think he was interested in listening to me either. So, you know, we parted friends and just never really did anything there. But were they busy? Was it a busy party?
There were a couple of holiday parties.
No, I'm talking about yours.
There were probably about 20 guys. It was a cigar while...
Well, that's definitely a male thing. You know, you're not going to get a lot of women chewing on bear, you know. And I hate to stereotype, but it's just absolutely the truth, you know. I have to watch it when I do any kind of dinners, even just a regular wine dinner, because... You know, certain people won't eat certain things, and it's gluten and it's allergies and that. But, you know, once you get into bear and kangaroo, you've thinned the herd considerably.
You know? But, you know, we felt cheated because there was no rattlesnake, there was no Komodo dragon, you know.
Well, yeah, you know, the Komodo dragons are kind of hard to harvest this time of year, you know. But anyway, I find those things interesting. I mean, I'm not, you know, I have access to all that stuff. I don't have access to bear, but I have access to antelope and kangaroo and all this other stuff. I don't know. I'm not all that interested in cooking that stuff, you know, because I know it's going to fall on deaf ears anyway, for the most part. You know, I do elk burgers.
We had elk, too, I believe. I think we had elk sausage, maybe.
Yeah. I've done elk, rack of elk. I've done elk burgers. And that kind of sells. You know, that's a little closer to beef than, you know, bear or lion would be. But, Yeah, it's. I think those dinners are interesting and should be attended by those curious enough to, you know, foster up the money. You know, so I got to tell you, I went to the Riverhead Suffolk Theater in Riverhead.
Yes.
Last Sunday to see Tab Benoit, a guy I've been listening to, a guitar player I've been listening to for a long time. And I've forgotten what a great little venue that is. You know, when I was there in the beginning, I took over the food service there right from the start. And ultimately, it didn't work out. But at the time, you know, we hadn't really done much of anything. And we had a guy who was kind of setting up the shows there that was sort of older in his thinking. I mean, I remember doing a 4-hour retrospective of Rex Harrison's career. You know, we had about, there was three people in the audience, you know, that were young enough to remember, excuse me, Rex Harrison. So the it wasn't good. I mean, we did a couple of big parties there. We did a gala opening, you know, I think we did a wedding or two or an engagement party. But the whole management thing changed, and then I wasn't happy with that, so I just drifted off. But I went there to see this Tab Benoit show, and, you know, it's really an intimate, very cool space. And they have tables set up, like almost like the Copacabana years ago, you know, there's little levels. You know, you can be a floor level, and then we were up one level a little bit to the left.
I went to see a show, I sat all the way in the back. They had like almost like a cocktail table.
Yeah, yeah. But these were great. And, you know, they serve food throughout the whole show until about a half an hour before the show ends, and then they stop food service. But, you know, it was great. We're sitting at the table with a couple bottles of wine. I was there with Val and Dorio and my friend Nick Rubino, and we just had a ball. And, you know, if you ever get a chance to see, I don't know if you like blues music out there.
Yes.
But if you do, Tab Benoit is as good as it gets. He's got that white boy swampy thing going on. He's from Louisiana. He's from Baton Rouge, you know. He's got that southern white boy bluesy swampy mix happening, and he's really good at it. And he's got a good voice. He's a good singer. His band is, I think, Terrence Higgins is the drummer. I think he's a pretty well-known guy down south. And his bass player, Corey, I can't remember his last name, not a great player. You know, they were just a smoking three-piece band. And the people that opened up for them were the Dirty Dozen Brass Band from New Orleans.
Really?
But there's only like seven guys in a Dirty Dozen band, which immediately annoyed me, right? I'm thinking this is a Baker's Half Dozen is what it is, you know? And it was fun. They had a tuba player, two saxes, a baritone, and a tenor. They had a trumpet player, a trombone player, and of all things, an Asian guitar player and a drummer, obviously. The drummer was a monster. He was great. The guitar player was good. The whole band was good. And I love that music. It was like Preservation Hall kind of thing, you know, all the horns. And there's a lot of power in those horns. You know, when you go to see a big band or a horn band like that, you sit back and it blows your hair back, you know. In my case, not in your case, Stu, but in my case, it blows your hair back. And it's a different experience. It's not that rock and roll thing, you know. I've been going to more shows lately. I went to see Bonamassa when he was at the beach, and now Tab, and I'm thinking about going to see Molly Hatchet. They're playing in January at the theater.
Really?
But I just fell in love with the theater. I thought it was such a great venue, and I'm like, wow, I'm glad this worked out for them, because, you know, it was an important thing for him to do. You know, he was trying to be part of the revival of Riverhead, which is, I think, a fabulous thing, you know, and Riverhead is starting to look different. You know, they have a couple of nice apartment buildings there. The Hyatt went up, you know. That's another great hotel. I stayed at the Hyatt that night because I didn't really feel like driving back, you know.
Really?
Yeah, it was great. We had a room facing the water there, the river in the back. Yeah, it was the room was fabulous. It was like a suite. It had a couch there and, you know, a desk and all of that. It was good. The whole night was really, really good night. And Mike ordered a pretzel. We all split a pretzel. It was a big Bavarian number, you know, the size of your head. And I couldn't have had a better Sunday night. It was just a lot of fun, you know. So if you get a chance, you know, I patronize him. He renovated this theater at his own expense. He didn't have a lot of help from the town. And hopefully the town will, you know, the town will respond. I mean, I think that, you know, when you watch towns, and this is like a little bit on the political side, which I always try and avoid, but if you look at Greenport had, there was a dark area of Greenport, you know, meaning that the criminal aspect there, it was, you know, there was trouble there. Greenport 15, 20 years ago was a sketchy town, you know, and then they had a mayor who had the courage to clean it up, you know, and now it's this thriving, beautiful place, you know.
Is Claudio still around?
Yeah, Claudio's still there. And the same needs to happen in Riverhead. Riverhead is, you know, everybody's willing to do that, but you need the political will to clean up. You know, you got to get the crackheads out of the traffic circle, the hookers off Main Street. You know, once you do that, then Mrs. USA will be comfortable walking down Main Street at 9 o'clock at night. Until you don't, if you don't, I mean, it's not going to happen. But, you know, places like the Riverhead Theater, the Preston House Hotel, you got the Hyatts there now. You got some guys trying to open restaurants and do the right thing. So, you know, hopefully the politicians will, you know, get it and, you know, and try and, you know, clean the place up. So it's presentable because Riverhead's gorgeous. I almost bought a loft there. I don't know if I ever told you. But there was a building there that housed like a sneaker place, right? And it was for sale and it was like, I'm going back a ways now. It was like $400,000 or whatever. So I'm looking at this building and I'm looking, all right, so you put something in the main floor, you rent there. The second floor had this beautiful apartment, high ceilings and whatever. But the third floor was what interested me. Third floor was a loft, Stu. It was just a, you know, brick from floor to ceiling, windows from floor to ceiling. It was like a loft in Soho. And I'm saying to my daughter, I said, you know, I can't afford a loft in Soho. I can afford a loft in Riverhead. But the problem was, you know, the renovations were, you know, probably $1.5 million or whatever by the time you got done. And then I had two cars at the time. And, you know, there's no garage. I'm not going to leave, you know, an expensive sport car out in the rain and whatever. Anyway, so long story short, I didn't do it. But, I'm kind of sorry I didn't. It was, you know, I could have sold the sports car and had a very cool, you know, apartment. But, yeah, cooler heads prevailed and it didn't work out. So that's the end of that. So let's take a little break. We'll pay some bills and we'll come back. Maybe we'll even talk about food.
Amano Osteria and Wine Bar has been created by Adam Lovett and Tom Shordell to bring the feel and flavors of a true Tuscan Osteria to the North Fork. Amano showcases local growers, farmers, cheese, and winemakers, marrying their ingredients with the taste traditions of the Tuscan countryside. The casual appeal, the flavors of Italy, and a moderate price structure appeal to all, ensuring year-round patronage. This North Fork eatery sends out snappy salads and seafood, pastas and antipasta, along with a respectable wine list. Amano features local vineyards and Italian varietals from the U.S. and Italian wines. The kitchen remains open until 11 and has established a later dining crowd, sparking a local nightlife dining scene. Amano is on the cutting edge of a new high-quality and affordable dining experience on the North Fork. Amano Osteria and Wine Bar, 13550 Main Road in Matatuck. Serving dinner daily, Amano is also open for lunch on Saturday and Sunday. For reservations and further information, call them at 631-298-4800 or visit them on the web at amanorestaurant.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Playing With Fire on 1100 WHLI and 104.7 WHLI FM, Long Island's own food, wine, and lifestyle show with your host, Tom Shordell, chef, author, and restaurateur.
Yeah, so we've been threatening to talk about food for about 3 weeks now still. What do you think, three, four weeks, something like that, you know? But all kinds of stuff gets in the way. You know, you got Christmas coming up. We can talk about the Christmas table. You got New Year's Eve coming up. A good excuse for caviar and champagne. We got a lot of... And then beyond that, you have Valentine's Day. So there's all kinds of, you know, things going. You know, I remember going to my grandmother's house sometime on Christmas, and she kind of had the same meal that you'd have on Thanksgiving. She always, like, roasted a turkey or a prime rib or something along those lines. And leaner years, a loin of pork, you know. But she always made this big dinner. And I was always like, that was almost half of Christmas to me. You know, as a kid, you know, you're opening gifts and stuff like that, it's always exciting. But as you get a little older, you know, you start to think about, man, there's other things involved here, you know, the family, the meal. And I know we've kind of taken that on in I don't have it in my house, I have it in my daughter's house, but, you know, she does a theme every year, you know, for Christmas. Like, you know, last couple of years it's been kind of Feliz Navidad, you know, she's been making tacos and empanadas and things like that for Christmas. This year she's doing a soul food Christmas, which is kind of fun. I have to do the ribs and the collard greens, And she's making, she's doing a corn thing, a mock shoe, and she's making cornbread. And I think she's doing a pork butt, you know, for like a pulled pork thing. So I'm looking forward to that. It's my kind of food. I can get into that in a big way, you know. Beans, we're doing maybe black-eyed peas, you know, Hoppin' John with rice. So it should be a fun fun day.
Sounds interesting.
Yeah, yeah, it's different, you know. And plus the kids, I like giving the kids, you know, different ethnic foods so they get them early, you know.
So way back when, there was a mother and daughter that had a soul food type restaurant.
Yeah, it was LL Dent.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Lisa and her mom. Yeah, I actually helped them open that place, you know. And they did a great job. They were there for 10 years. I think that was the length of their lease. And then, like landlords can do, wanted to raise the rent, and they just didn't think it would be worth it.
You really are amazing, because that was a story I wanted to talk about, landlords and restaurants, because, you know, again, we try to avoid talking about food.
Yeah, well, I have some landlord stories. I've had the worst landlord ever, and I've had the best landlord ever, and a couple in the middle.
So my story goes to, it's holiday related.
Yeah.
So Hanukkah has come.
Right.
And almost gone. And my family used to go to Pastrami King in Merrick, and we would probably dine there on one of the weekends that have all my kids and their other half.
Yeah.
Some of the boys are not Jewish, so they get scared from, you know, chopped liver and gefilte fish and all that stuff.
Well, it's with good reason.
And the wonders about Pastrami King is it was kosher style, so it had more of a variety and also some Nauvoo type of offerings. There might be pastrami sliders or whatever. And the long and short of it is we really enjoyed it. It was a nice time.
Yeah, yeah.
So back in July, they lost their lease.
Yeah.
They closed up, and apparently it became a whole big thing. There was TV crews there and this
really?
That. I guess they originally had started in Forest Hills and then moved to Merrick. But it was Hanukkah. You know, potato latkes were on my mind.
Yeah.
And I called Joe Yamali, who was the proprietor, and I was checking in because in today's world, there's ghost kitchens and this and that, and I didn't know if he was going to do any of that. And
right,
his
right.
brother's in the catering business.
Uh-huh.
It's Butch Yamali, who has Dover Catering, and he has a couple of – he has the Carl House, and he used to have the Sands down in Long Beach.
Oh, Long Beach, yeah, yeah. Lido
Atlantic,
or whatever.
Lido or whatever.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if that's still there. He has Peter's Clam Bar. So I just called. I just thought it would be interesting to check and see how he was doing. But he told me the story, and it really is heartbreaking, but there's like a sense of satisfaction built in there. So apparently the landlord sold the property, and it's in Merrick, east of the Meadowbrook Parkway. And the landlord owned the Dunkin' Donuts, and he owned the property that Pastrami King was on. He said he was looking to sell. So the story I heard was that Joe thought, well, you know, maybe I'll buy the property and be able to control my own destiny.
Yeah, yeah.
And he reached out to some real estate people, and lo and behold, one of them made an offer on the property.
Really?
But, again, this is one version of the story, but what's intriguing is that supposedly was a younger guy, but Joe had gotten a couple of valuations on the property, and what he's led to believe is the guy paid more than he should have for it.
Uh-huh.
So that's why he got the property and Joe didn't.
Right.
But here we are, December, so that's July, August, September, October, mm-hmm. November. If December's over, 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
So Pastrami King's been gone for 6 months, and that building is empty.
Yeah.
So between paying more than market value and losing revenue for 6 months doesn't seem to be a good business model.
No. Sometimes landlords, I think that I don't know what the deal is because I'm not a commercial landlord at the moment, but the bottom line is, you know, I think some of them almost want to lose money for the tax base, for the tax purposes? Because I've seen people go, you know, a year, 2 years, 3 years without a tenant because they won't bring their price down. So you can't tell me that's not on purpose. You know, at some point, you know, you realize, okay, that I'm asking. It's like you go to sell your house. You know, I think my house is worth $1 million. Problem is the buyers think it's worth $600,000. You know what I mean? So you either go with the buyer or you sit there, you know, with your house. And so it's the same thing, you know. I'll tell you funny stories about – I'll tell you about the best landlord I ever had. And this is kind of antithetical to what usually happens because it's a big group. It's you've heard of Rexon, right? Rexon Associates.
Sure.
I mean, they have buildings everywhere, all over Long Island, Manhattan, whatever. Mitchell Reckler, who is one of the brothers, his brothers and cousins involved in this, you know. But he's one of the principals, Mitchell. And when I was at Lemongrass, and Mitchell called me up. I had 107 and I had Lemongrass at the time. So Mitchell calls me up and he goes, "Hey, Tom, I have this location at Syosset. You know, be good for a restaurant for you. Want to come and take a look?" And I was so inundated with, you know, employee issues and whatever. I said, I need another restaurant like I need an enema, you know. So I'm not going to – no, thanks, Mitch. I'm not – I appreciate you calling me. I'm not interested. So I hang up. 2 days later, he calls me again. He says, "You sure, man? This is a pretty good spot, you know, and I think you'd like it. It's over on Jericho Turnpike in Syosset, you know." And I'm thinking, yeah, Jericho Turnpike in Syosset, it's a pretty good location, you know. So I couldn't really picture where it was. I said, "You know what? Thanks, though, Mitch. I got my hands full here. I can't do it, you know." And I started to think, I'm thinking like, well, we're kind of running out of room at 107, you know. Maybe I could. So he calls me again, and he says, "You know, you really got to come. Just come and take a look, right?" So looking's what I do. I go down there, and I see this restaurant space. It was kind of in disrepair, you know. But it had some equipment in the kitchen. It was usable and stuff. I guess they had gone out 6 or 7 months before. So I said, "You know what? If I keep saying no, he's going to go screw you and give it to somebody else." So I finally said yes, and I decided I was going to sell 107 and move, quote-unquote, the virtual 107 over to Syosset. Problem was I couldn't call it 107 Forest Avenue because it's now a 6800 Jericho Turnpike, and I'm not going to call it 6800 Jericho Turnpike. So it became Coolfish. That's how it happened. So Mitchell said to me, there's a little cafe on the other side of the building that comes with this lease. He said, "I want you to run a cafe." I'm like, "I don't know anything about bagels and eggs and stuff like that." He says, "Well, I'll give you X amount of money if you get this thing open and run it." And it was a very large amount of money, six-figure amount of money, right? He says, "But I can't put it in the lease because I don't want my brothers and, you know, bother me about this." I said, "So let me get this straight. I'm going to open this place. You're going to give me all this money, right? But we have no agreement other than your word." He goes, "Yeah, my word's good." I really had no, you know, leverage with it, right? So I said, "All right, whatever." You know, I never expected it to happen. So it turns out I wound up renting the space to a friend of mine. And we fixed it up and we got it open. And the day we got it open, he handed me a check for the amount of money he told me he was going to hand me. And Mitchell was great. I mean, he gave me a year's worth of free rent to build it, you know, helped me out. The rent was probably less than market value, but it couldn't have been fairer. He was a great customer. They were the best landlord ever, Rexon Associates. And then they went to they broke up the company. It became something else. I don't remember what it was.
Because I know I had some familiarity with Scott Reckler.
Yeah, Scott. Scott was Mitchell's cousin. And so Scott, RXR, that's what it was. They became RXR. It split up. The cousins split up. Mitchell went, and he's got that building over on the expressway. And Scott had a lot of stuff going on in the city. He's huge, Scott, you know. Anyway, it became RXR, and it was still fine, but it was a little more corporate. You know, if I call, well, you got to file, put in an application for the repair, and it's, you know, if I call Mitchell sent a plumber down. It was great, you know. And so anyway, that was the greatest. The worst one I ever had was at Panama Hattie's. And there was a guy, I won't tell you who his name is, it doesn't matter, he was the landlord there, right? We ran out of money about two-thirds of the way through the build. And he says, "Well, how much money is it going to take for you to finish this thing?" I said, "Probably about $30,000. So he says, "I'll tell you, I'll give you the money. I'll lend you the money, and you pay me back." I said, okay. He says, but you have to sign a CCC agreement, which is a UCC agreement, which is a uniform commercial code, which basically signs over the property that you have in the restaurant, like the furniture, fixtures, the chairs, this, that, and the other thing. It's like a chattel mortgage to the owner, so he's got something on you, you know, mm-hmm. for the money, right? So I said, okay, well, no problem, you know. So I signed this UCC agreement, giving him the title to the furniture and fixtures and everything in the building. Well, it turns out, you know, I pay him back the $30,000 over 2 years or a year and a half, whatever it was. And I essentially laundered $30,000 for him is what I did. And about 4 or 5 years later, I'm assuming once I paid him back, that's the end of the UCC agreement. I didn't know you have to have a completely different, you know, legal thing. You got to go unsign them with the lawyers and this, that, and the other thing, right? So turns out I get an offer on Panama Hatties 4 or 5 years later that I wanted to take, which was a lot of money. And so I said, okay, yeah, but now I can't sell the place until I get the UCC agreements back, right? So I go to this landlord and I said, you know, I gave you the money. You got to give me the UCC. I don't have to give you anything. I said, what do you mean? He said, I don't have to give you anything. He says, UCC agreements are still intact. I still own the furniture and fixtures. I said, but I gave you the money. I gave you the $30,000 back with interest, by the way. He goes, tough. He says, you know, buyer beware, whatever. I couldn't believe it. I was like, what? So he says, I tell you what. He says, I'll give you the UCC agreements back. I'll unsign them.
How much?
$50,000. I said, are you kidding? So I'm thinking to myself, well, now, could I have him killed for less than $50,000, you know? It took me about 2 weeks to, you know, unthink that, you know. I've never been so angry in my life. Anyway, long story short, I gave him the $50,000. I had no choice, right? About 5 years later, I bump into his lawyer who was involved in these negotiations. And he's kind of a, you know, small guy, you know, just a, you know, white-collar business guy. And I bump into him in a restaurant, and I could see he was visibly afraid, you know, that I was going to go off, you know. So he said, I just want you to know that I had nothing to do with that. It was all Barry's, you know. Keith, I get it. Don't worry about it. I'm not mad at you. I said, he goes, you know, he just passed away. I said, really? He said, yeah. I said, what happened? He said, he had a heart attack. I said, that's impossible. He didn't have one, you know. Anyway, he goes, you know who was at the wake? I said, who? Me and his wife. Is that any indication of how you lived your life? When two people show up at your wake and they're both obligated. I mean, no, he says, we were the only two people there at the wake.
That's crazy.
Yeah, so that's
interesting you talk about the Reckler family, just real quick. But you talk about considerate people and over-the-top nice. So I used to do some driving to make extra money.
Yeah.
So usually you're driving the limo company's vehicle.
Yeah.
But for this one Saturday night, I was assigned as a private driver for Scott Reckler.
Uh-huh.
And using his vehicle, they had an SUV or whatever.
Yeah.
So I get over there. It's him and his wife. They were going somewhere.
Yeah, Debbie. Yeah.
And during the trip, wherever I was taking them, they decided to watch a movie. But what blew me away was the wife saying to Scott, let's use the headphones because Stu's going to be sitting around all night. Maybe he wants to watch the movie. And, I mean, that was like, oh, my God, over the top. Which was just another quick similar story is drive somebody over to Arthur Avenue one night. And they go in to eat. And, you know, so I'm killing time. I go and get a burger somewhere or whatever.
Yeah.
But they come back. And next thing I know, the restaurant owner is bringing me out a plate of food.
Really?
You know, silverware and nice. A napkin and on a regular plate. And he goes, you shouldn't have to sit out here and not get to enjoy my food.
Nice, nice.
You know, and I'm going, oh, my God. When you experience something like that, it's like, you know, life without expectations. You know, it's amazing when gratuitously somebody is over the top nice to you. And, you know, as compared to, I was listening to a story last night about something, And somebody was saying that, I don't know, it might have been at a restaurant, but or it was at a clothing store. It was something bad happened.
Yeah.
And then the customer comes back, like, with demands, you know.
Oh, yeah, what are
this
you gonna do
is
for
gonna
me?
Be how you remedy the
yeah,
situation.
What are you going to do for me?
You know, and it's like, wow, you know, some people are just like.
Yeah. But I think the restaurant industry is kind of a yin thing. It's almost like a, you know, I don't want to again get misogynistic, but it's a female kind of nurturing, giving thing, you know, and I think that's I think service is you know critical. You here we are, X amount of years later, and you still remember that act of kindness, you know. We had I told this story before about Sidney Feldstein, and the reason I use his name is because he's no longer with us. He was like my favorite customer ever. He was the most cantankerous, ornery son of a bee you've ever met in your life, and we couldn't have been happier to see him every day. He would come in for lunch. He must have eaten a cool fish literally 600 times, never had a good meal. Soup was never hot enough. All he did was complain. He was hilarious. So one day he doesn't show up, and we used to set our watches by Sidney coming in, right? We set our watches by him. Where's Sidney? He's not here. I just didn't realize. She goes, no, he hasn't come in. Has he called? No, whatever. So we call this, you know, we call his house to see if, you know, he was home or we were going to call the hospitals and check the emergency rooms, you know? So he picks up the phone, and my manager goes, Sidney, it's Diana Coolfish. What do you want? He's like in his Sidney kind of way. She goes, we were just worried about you. She goes, you know, you're not here, usually here. Well, it's snowing out. I don't want to drive. I'm afraid to drive. She goes, you want us to come and pick you up? You would do that? Of course we'd do that, right? So we went to pick him up. So then every time there was a weather event, like, you know, partly cloudy or a chance of showers, you know, he'd call for the pickup and we'd have to go get him. And we did it for probably the last 2 years of his life that we knew. And it was funny because when he passed away, his son had called us up at Coolfish and thanked us for being so kind to him. And he goes, I know my father could be a handful. I said, your father was the best customer we ever had. He was the biggest pain in the ass, but we couldn't wait to see him. He was just hilarious. He told me one time, his soup was never hot enough. It's the thing with old people, you know. You can't get the soup hot enough. I don't know if they have burnt taste buds or whatever. But he sent back the soup every time. It's not hot. It's not hot. It's not hot. So one day we send out a bowl of soup. He doesn't even taste it. He goes, take it back like that, right? So Diane goes, Sidney, you haven't even tasted it yet. I haven't tasted it. 700 times I've eaten here. 700 times the soup's been cold. What, today? All of a sudden, he was like a Catskills comedian. He had us on the floor, man. He was dead serious. Take it back. I know it's not hot. Oh, my God. He was a piece of work. But we couldn't wait to see him. He was the best.
No, it again, in the book of being nice to people, I used to remember, for whatever reason, over at Jewel, you used to have like a bus, not a bus boy, but he would bring you the butter or
the bread or whatever. Yeah.
And the guy was the nicest guy. And I, you know, go in my pocket, give him $5, like when I sat down. And, it felt good.
Yep.
He appreciated it.
Yeah.
And he paid a little more attention to us.
Listen, I judge people's character by how they treat people they don't need. You know what I mean? Everybody treats people they need really well. If you treat somebody you don't need really well, it's an indication of who you are. And so I'm going to leave everybody with that thought.
Holiday and maybe season. Next week we'll talk food.
Maybe next week I'll give you a recipe or two. If I'm in the mood, I don't know. We'll see. Anyway, we're going to leave with Tom's three keys to life like usual. Life is too short to drink bad wine. Treat every meal like it was your last. Keep chocolate in your life as important as sex and pizza. And have a happy Hanukkah for the next day or two, and we'll see you next week.
Amano Osteria and Wine Bar has been created by Adam Lovett and Tom Shordell to bring the feel and flavors of a true Tuscan Osteria to the North Fork. Amano showcases local growers, farmers, cheese, and winemakers, marrying their ingredients with the taste traditions of the Tuscan countryside. The casual appeal, the flavors of Italy, and a moderate price structure appeal to all, ensuring year-round patronage. This North Fork eatery sends out snappy salads and seafood, pastas and antipasta, along with a respectable wine list. Amano features local vineyards and Italian varietals from the U.S. and Italian wines. The kitchen remains open until 11 and has established a later dining crowd, sparking a local nightlife dining scene. Amano is on the cutting edge of a new high-quality and affordable dining experience on the North Fork. Amano Osteria and Wine Bar, 13550 Main Road in Matatuck. Serving dinner daily, Amano is also open for lunch on Saturday and Sunday. For reservations and further information, call them at 631-298-4800 or visit them on the web at amanorestaurant.com.